From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're learning more about the gunman who killed 26 people yesterday during services at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Officials say Devin Kelly's former mother-in-law attended the church and that Kelly had sent her threatening texts. Texas Public Safety Director Freeman Martin says Kelly did not have a license to carry a gun, but owned 4 firearms purchased over the last 4 years.
The suspect did have a non-commissioned, unarmed private security license, similar to a security guard at a concert type situation. There were no disqualifiers entered into the National Crime Information Center database that would preclude him from receiving a private security license.
Well, Colin Dwyer is covering the story for NPR.org, and he joins us now. Hi there, Colin.
Hello.
So, first of all, tell us, what more do we know about how Kelly got the weapons that he used? Because we just heard that cut where the officials are saying he had an unarmed security guard's license.
That's right. So this is going to be an ongoing question as we go forward in the investigation. But here's what we know at the moment. It doesn't appear that he had a license to carry the weapon. We do know that he purchased a weapon once a year, beginning in 2014. So he purchased a gun in 2014, a gun in 2016 and 17. And some of those guns were on him during the course of the shooting. He actually had an assault-style rifle that he brought into the church with him. And then 2 more weapons were found in his vehicle after authorities found him dead.
Mm. Now, did officials describe or say more about what exactly happened inside the church?
Yes, and that is another scene that we are getting more detail on. It appears that at about 11:20, neighbors called in a suspicious man who was nearby a convenience store right across the street from the church. That man then walked across the street toward the church. He was dressed in a black tactical vest. He had a mask on him. He was carrying that assault-style rifle. He opened fire on the church while he was still outside, and then he walked inside and kept firing. During the course of that shooting, he actually killed 23 people inside the church. Another 2 people were killed outside, and one died on the way to medical attention. Then, after the suspect exited the church, he went to go get in his vehicle, at which point a local resident actually broke out a firearm of his own and began shooting at the suspect. At that point, Kelly dropped his gun, got in his vehicle, and began to drive away. Apparently, he actually called his father in the course of this pursuit, but later he was found in his vehicle after it had crashed, together with those weapons.
So do we know then if Kelly had shot himself, or did he die as a result of the person who had been following him?
It appears at the moment that authorities believe that it was a self-inflicted wound.
Okay. Now, about the victims, we're also learning that many of them were children, right?
That's correct. And that's one of the truly terrible elements of this story, is that authorities said that the ages of the victims range anywhere from 18 months at the youngest inside the church to up to 77 years old. And we still don't know those victims' names yet. We will get those officially released as time goes on, as those victims' families are told about the tragedy.
And in the minute that we have to go here, Colin, did officials say anything today about whether or not they know if Kelly's actions were connected to the fact that his former mother-in-law is a member of the church, even though she wasn't at services yesterday?
It appears at the moment that this attack was not racially or religiously motivated. That is what authorities said at the news conference. It appears that there was an ongoing dispute with his in-laws, specifically his mother-in-law. At this point, that is just about as far as authorities were willing to bring it. They described it as a quote-unquote domestic situation, and we will be following it from there.
Mm. Well, Colin Dwyer is reporting this story for NPR.org. Colin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump addressed the church massacre in Texas while on his visit to Japan today. He said the shooting wasn't a guns situation, it was a mental health problem. He also said North Korea was a threat to the civilized world.
We will not stand for that. The era of strategic patience is over.
Well, the president will be in South Korea tomorrow, and joining us from Seoul is NPR's Elise Hu. Elise, some tough words in Japan about North Korea. How are those words going to play where you are in South Korea?
It depends on the audience, because South Koreans largely view Trump with a mix of wariness and bemusement. He does have some supporters. The hardline right-wing conservatives in South Korea are very aligned with Trump's hardline policies on the North. But by and large, South Koreans are wary of a lot of the rhetoric that they believe stirs up tensions in a way that's unnecessary.
Are we likely to see any protests in South Korea?
So many protests, because South Korea is a protest culture. So there's going to be demonstrations against President Trump. There's going to be demonstrations for President Trump. There were so many permits requested to demonstrate during the time he is in Seoul that the president and his staff actually requested that the police try and organize the protest permitting process such that there are only two main protests happening in the main central square, one for and one against. So the protest groups are going to essentially be organized into two main demonstrations now.
You were with the president in Tokyo. Were there protests there?
No, and that's what's going to be unique about the South Korea leg of it. Japan doesn't have the same spirit of protest in its culture. And when it does, when I've attended demonstrations in Japan, they tend to be quite orderly. And often the protesters stay along the sidewalk. So they're really interesting in the difference between the Japanese and the South Koreans when it comes to protest culture.
What about the relationship between President Trump and the South Korean President Moon Jae-in? President Moon said last week that the South's top priority is to maintain peace on the peninsula. So how will he react with President Trump's rhetoric on North Korea?
President Moon Jae-in has made efforts to forge a relationship with President Trump, but it is noticeably not as strong as that of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Trump. And that's for a few different reasons. Some of it is stylistic. Some of it is because Moon disagrees with Trump in small ways when it comes to North Korea and also trade. And both those issues are going to be centerpieces of their discussions during this South Korea leg of a long Asia trip for the president.
Well, there's a relatively new trade deal between the U.S. and South Korea. It's called CORUS. President Trump has criticized it. He says it's one reason the U.S. has a trade deficit with South Korea. Is the trade agreement in jeopardy?
The trade agreement is they are in early stages of possibly renegotiating it. Trump has said he wants to change or abandon the agreement, which was enacted under President Obama. It eliminates many tariffs and other trade barriers. But many business leaders in both Korea and the United States have said it's a useful policy and that it helped propel the $112 billion trade relationship with South Korea, which is the United States' sixth largest goods partner, and South Korea itself is Asia's fourth largest economy.
Elise, what does South Korea want to get out of this visit by President Trump?
Because there's been so much tension on the peninsula over the past few months after North Korea's sixth nuclear test, and also because both Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump have been trading fiery rhetoric back and forth, I think Moon Jae-in really wants to try and impress on the president that, hey, we should tone things down. We should look for a peaceful resolution. And if there are considerations of military options on the peninsula, you need to consult South Korea in advance, because one of the promises that Moon has made to the South Koreans is that there would be no action militarily by the United States without South Korea getting some sort of veto or at least be part of that discussion.
Now, Elise, I just have to ask you while we have you about a moment that happened today. President Trump and Prime Minister Abe were feeding some fish in a koi pond, and there was some uproar on Twitter after President Trump dumped his box of fish food into the pond. What more do we know about what happened there or what should have happened?
That's right. So the context here is that Prime Minister Abe and President Trump were spooning fish food into a koi pond. But after this photo op, a photo of Donald Trump dumping the entire box of fish food into the pond came out. And so there was some uproar about this, worry that these fish would die because they were overfed. But as it turns out, Prime Minister Abe was first to dump the whole box of food into the pond. So Trump was actually just following his host. So despite the uproar, this ended up being a bit of a non-story in the end.
Good thing for the fish, I guess.
We hope so.
That's NPR's Elise Hu joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Elise, thank you.
You bet.
And our next guests are part of a truly modern family, one with three parents and a baby. The family is made up of a straight married couple, Zeke House father and his wife, Avery Kent. They just had a baby, Octavia. And then there's a third parent, Zeke and Avery's longtime friend and a longtime friend of mine, David J., also known as DJ. They're all with us from San Francisco, where they live. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
And Zeke and Avery, I want to start with you. Why did you, as the biological parents, decide that you wanted to have a third parent?
So we have been together about 7 years and have known David for pretty much that whole length of time. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of family here in the Bay Area. And we knew, as entrepreneurs and people who value our careers and multifaceted parts of our lives, that when we decided to have a child, that we would want support and we would want to be part of a larger community in that effort, not only to help us, but also to help our daughter, or at that point, future child, have access and exposure to lots of different points of view and lots of really incredible people that we know. And so the process started many years ago with David in talking about how we may come together as a family. It didn't start with this idea of being co-parents.
Who brought up that idea for the first time?
I think it was Avery and myself. You know, we were talking to DJ just broadly about how we'd involve him in our daughter's life, and we had been having conversations similar to that with a number of our friends of, you know, trying to make them a chosen family of sorts. And, you know, we had this long conversation with DJ around exactly how he wanted to be involved, and you know, at one point we're like, well, you know, there's sort of this range, you know, it could be as little as this or as much as this. And as the conversation sort of progressed, you know, we kind of realized that maybe it actually would work out really well to have him not just as sort of a supporting adult in a child's life, but as an equal parent.
And to be fair, Zeke, you brought it up first, but I was dropping hints. It was very much on my mind as a possibility that I wanted.
Well, and David, we should say you are asexual. You define yourself as asexual, but you are in a relationship with a woman in New York who's not part of this co-parenting situation.
Yes, that's correct. So for me, as an asexual person, I'd kind of always known I wanted kids, but felt it was pretty unlikely that I was going to have kids in a traditional way. And I've always formed really close, committed relationships with my friends, including friends that are couples. And so even when I was in my 20s and thinking about what might kids look like to me, the possibility that I might form a committed relationship with a couple and help them raise one or more children was really appealing to me. And then I met my partner in 2011, and it became pretty clear early on that she didn't want kids, and I really did. And so what I said to her was, look, I'm going to find a way to have kids in my life. If our relationship can be flexible, if we can each have the room to do what we need to do, then I'll find a way to have kids in my life, and you can make your own decision about whether or not you want to have kids. And what we wound up realizing was it makes a lot of sense for me to be a co-parent and for her to be a person in the child's life, but not to be primarily, you know, bottle feeding at 4 a.m.
And is that working for the two of you?
Yeah. So, well, right now we're long distance. So she's in New York. I'm here in San Francisco. We talk on the phone a few times a week. We text all the time. I'm sending back and forth baby pictures. Eventually, the plan is for her to move out here.
So Zeke or Avery, as you were figuring out how to make this happen along with David, What kind of things were you thinking about? What were the concerns that came up?
So it was less about concerns and more about what were our values. So we really started this process about 3 years ago, so long before I was pregnant and pretty much shortly after Zeke and I had actually gotten married. And one of the frameworks that we found really helpful was thinking about time and what kind of commitments each of us would make around time, both with ourselves and with our child. Responsibility. So who is responsible for what? How do those decisions get made? We also looked at financial commitments and what would that look like in terms of financial agreements. And then finally, discipline. And what were our theories and our values and our frameworks around that? And one of the processes that we did on a long weekend with more post-it notes than I can count was actually really each of us sharing and looking at our childhoods and what were the things that we loved, that we really valued and wanted to carry forward into our family. What were the things that were not ideal and that we might want to avoid in the future? And what were things that were maybe missing that we wish we had had or that we've learned, you know, since then from other people about their experiences that we would want to include? And so by having that framework and that structure for what it meant to be family, it gave us this really safe container to explore that. And from there, we were able to progress the conversation in terms of what our involvement together would look like practically, logistically, and legally.
Right. You drew up a legal document, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we're in the process of, in California, it is possible to have a third parent legally adopt a child. So we're in the process of pursuing third parent adoption, though we won't find out for maybe another year or so whether that goes through.
Yeah. And one of the main reasons to do that is, you know, we had all these conversations and DJ could have been a parent in name, even if it wasn't legally recognized. But the reason we decided to go for a legal adoption is because even though he can make binding financial commitments to support the kid, he still has no legal rights as anything but a parent. So sort of the third-party adoption gives us a way to, you know, make sure that he has rights that go along with the responsibilities he's committing to in our daughter's life.
So I was thinking about the division of labor here, and you talked about how that was something you had to figure out. It makes sense during the day, or it might be easier during the day. What about that 3 a.m. feeding in the middle of the night?
So initially, Avery had to bear a lot of that responsibility because the baby had to, you know, breastfeed.
Right.
But ever since week three or so, you know, since we've been able to bottle feed her with stored breast milk, DJ's been able to help out for half the night. So we now divide the night into two shifts. Avery and I take one shift. He takes the other, either late or early. And in his shift, the baby is in his room, sleeping in a little bassinet there. And, you know, he bottle feeds her when she wakes up, changes her diaper, et cetera. So we get a lot better rested. And we also get to spend a lot more time, you know, together as a couple. You know, in some ways, I think it's really good for our relationship. A lot of our friends who've recently had children are, you know, fairly stressed out. Their relationships are, you know, it is complicated whenever you're dealing with something like that. Whereas we can take date nights once a week. We can, you know, sleep together without the baby for a good chunk of time. You know, it's really helpful.
Are there any downsides?
I think we had to put a lot of work into laying a lot of groundwork and how we wanted to communicate, how we wanted to make decisions together. Like, you know, you're turning a two-person complicated decision-making process into a three-person process. And that takes a lot of groundwork. It took years of building trust. It took us really kind of taking the script of parenting and holding it up on the wall and saying, okay, what about this we want to keep? What about this we want to change? So I think it took a lot of intentionality, but that work is really paying off in that all of us get this beautiful, amazing child in our life and get a lot of support. I think a lot more support than most parents get.
Yeah. And at least, you know, as people who live in San Francisco, which isn't necessarily the most representative part of the country, arrangements like these aren't quite as unusual as they might be in other places.
Though I'd push back, you know, speaking as the person from Missouri here, that though kind of legal third parents are not as common, I think that raising kids in community and raising in kids in community that you really take the time and energy to build is as old as human history.
Yeah.
And we're just finding a new form of, you know, anyone who says, hey, I'm having a kid and I'm going to sit down with my friends and talk about how often they want to come by and have a relationship with this kid. And I think that the practice of community parenting is one that exists everywhere.
one of the things that I think gave me training wheels on this a little bit that helped the process was I'm a godmother to another little girl. And I saw the difference where I had two sets of friends who had babies pretty much around the same time. But in one relationship, I was really intentionally invited in. And when she was little, I was being taught how to feed her the bottle. I was changing her diapers when I was over. I was taught how to put her down for her naps. I was reading books to her. I was one of the first people to babysit her without other, you know, family around. And so there was just this real invitation to do the things that a parent would normally do. And so by experiencing that long before we were, you know, actually pregnant or even really talking about the timeline of becoming pregnant, I'd had that taste of the power of invitation and what that could mean with your friends, to ask them to be a part and to show them how to do that.
Now, it's one thing to co-parent a baby. What about when Octavia grows up? What are you thinking? I mean, she may decide that, you know, she wants to go to one of you to ask for permission for something after the others say no.
Oh, triangulation.
Right. Yeah, we have some communication back channels we've set up for that purpose. But one of the things that's been really important is figuring out our communication. So we, you know, have a weekly family meeting where we sit down and say, all right, what are the kinds of decisions we might have to make? What are the, you know, rules around TV when she gets old enough to know about that, so that we can make sure that our decisions are consistent?
Those are co-parents David J., Avery Kent, and Zeke Housefather. Their baby Octavia is just a couple of months old. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks.
And you can see a photo and read more about this modern family at hereandnow.org. And let us know, what do you think about co-parenting a child? Have you thought about it? Again, hereandnow.org.
And let's take a break from the news for a postcard from Del Mar, California. That's where they held the Breeders' Cup horse races over the weekend. The Breeders' Cup is a series of high-stakes contests known as horse racing's Super Bowl. And Here and Now's Alex Ashlock was there.
The moon still hung in the sky when work began at the Del Mar racetrack before dawn Saturday morning. A transistor radio perched on a worn wooden shelf played outside a stall in the trackside barn. Horses were being walked, groomed, and shoed. This work has to be done, whether it's the Super Bowl of horse racing or just another day at the track. And either way, there's always time for breakfast for the thoroughbreds and the folks who tend to them.
Bacon burrito!
The Del Mar racetrack opened in 1937, the brainchild of singer Bing Crosby and some of his Hollywood pals. Joe Harper is president of the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club.
People came and said, oh my gosh, there's, you know, there's Lana Turner, there's Ava Gardner, there's all these great stars of those years. And that was, I mean, it was a great marketing tool in the world, and it probably still is. So it really put us on. And then the second year we were in operation down here, Seabiscuit showed up for a match race, so we were off and running.
To secure the event, Del Mar had to be renovated at a cost of tens of millions of dollars. They also had to make the track safer after more than a dozen horses died here in 2016. Fatalities are down now, and this weekend's races went off without a hitch. And thousands of hardcore racing fans came from all over to watch. Darren Vandover of Kansas City, Missouri, has been to 18 Breeders' Cups. He was trackside studying the daily racing form, which has the latest statistics on the horses.
What is it about horse racing that makes you so passionate about it?
Oh, we think we're smarter than everyone else, and at the end of the day, we're not. But it's the thought we are. Look at the weather out here. San Diego's a dream. So, best track in the world right here, Del Mar.
Alex Fineri owns Midnight Storm, who is running in one of the races on Saturday.
Well, I feel great. I just hope the horse feels great.
Well, not so much. Midnight Storm finished 12th in his race. But these big-time horse racing events are about much more than what happens on the track. Christine Moore set up shop in the plaza next to the grandstand, selling flamboyant hats.
It's part of it to wear a hat, you know, for the races. It's the sport of kings.
As far as I know, there weren't any kings at this year's Breeders' Cup, but Paul and Yolanda Bolda came from Phoenix, Arizona.
Love the horses.
Love the pony. We used to be thoroughbred owners with the couple behind us. Yeah. And, so we love the ponies, love the action, and the hope, the promise of maybe some big winnings.
Wearing number 5, the thoroughbred Gunrunner soared to victory in the biggest race of the day, the $6 million Breeders' Cup Classic. And that was the end of a day at the races where the turf meets the surf. Because the Pacific Ocean is just a few lengths away. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Hatchcock.
Where the turf meets the surf, down at Old El Mar, take a plane, take a train, take a car. There's a smile on every face, and a winner in each race, where the turf meets the surf at Del Mar.
Listening to Here and Now. It may be hard to wrap your head around the enormity of the events that took place in Saudi Arabia this weekend. A Lebanese prime minister traveled to Riyadh in order to resign. A missile was intercepted and detonated also over Riyadh. And then there's the news that some of the country's highest profile princes and businessmen had been arrested in an anti-corruption sweep. So what does this Saudi show of force mean, and what could it lead to? Well, joining us now with some insight is Rami Khoury. He's a professor at the American University of Beirut and also a senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he joins us in the studio. Rami Khoury, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, it's hard to believe that all of this took place in some 24 hours this weekend. So let's just start at the beginning, Rami, if we could. First, there's the resignation of Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri on Saturday. Why did he resign, and why did he go to Riyadh in order to do that?
Well, he probably went to Riyadh not expecting to be told that he was going to resign. This is the general assumption of most observers who know the region, and he clearly read out a statement that was written for him. It was on Saudi television from Riyadh. That's not normally how you resign, but the assumption is that he was not able to achieve the goals that the Saudis wanted him to achieve as prime minister. He's a Saudi-Lebanese dual national. He's politically very, very close to the Saudis, and he represents the Sunnis of Lebanon. That's how the system works, and the Saudis see themselves as guardians of the Sunnis. So all these things together caused the Saudis to assume at one point that they really wanted a change, related not to Lebanon, but to Hezbollah, Iran, and other things.
Because Hariri named Hezbollah in those statements that you were talking about.
Well, Hezbollah was in Hariri's cabinet.
Right, they were part of the government.
Right, and yeah. They have been for some couple of decades now, and they're in the parliament. They're a very legitimate, powerful force in the country, but they're at odds with many people, including Hariri, but Hariri had no choice. So the governance in Lebanon works by compromise, and Hariri had to make a big compromise to accept to be prime minister with the president being very close to the Syrians, and he did it, and they did achieve some things in the cabinet. So it wasn't a total failure, but in the final analysis, he really wasn't his own man.
I see. Interesting, because in those remarks on Saturday, Hariri said that I want to tell Iran and its followers that they're losing their influence in the region. Okay, so that happened, and then just a couple of hours later, Houthi rebels in Yemen launched a ballistic missile targeting the international airport in Riyadh. Why did they even try to do something like that?
Well, because the Saudis and the Emiratis have launched the war 3 years ago on Yemen, which has been devastating, leading to tens of thousands of deaths and all kinds of massive problems in the country. The country's shattered, and about 80% of people depend on food aid. The water's running out, etc. There's massive cholera epidemic.
I mean, many people are pointing at the Saudi bombing of Yemeni infrastructure as a source of this humanitarian disaster.
Well, it's one of the key reasons for it, and this war just goes on and on. The Americans, by the way, are refueling Saudi airplanes and helping them with satellite intelligence. So there's a direct American link to the Saudi-Emirati bombing of Yemen as well. But the Houthis and others who are not happy with what is going on in the war basically are fighting back in different ways on the ground, but as well as sending missiles to Saudi Arabia, which scares the daylights out of Saudis as well as other people in the Gulf who possibly might be targeted as well. There's a war going on, and in a war, both people shoot at each other.
Yeah. Well, we should note that, of course, the missile was intercepted and destroyed, according to the Saudis. But as you were pointing out, Rami, this is the first time that the heart of the Saudi capital was the target of an attack like this. What might this mean for Saudis amping up their proxy war in Yemen? I mean, again, it's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, really going on in Yemen.
Partly. The Iranians have very, very thin links with the Houthis and others in Yemen before the war started. They've upgraded those links a little bit now. But this is not a major proxy war in Yemen. Lebanon it is, Syria it is, other places, okay. Iraq it is. But Yemen, but it's becoming one. And this is the great tragic irony of what the Saudis and others are doing. By launching this war, they've forced the Houthis and others to lean more on Iranian assistance. They've increased Iran's strategic linkages with people in Yemen and other places, and therefore they've expanded Iran's strategic depth in the region rather than reducing it, as was the aim. And they may be trying to do the same thing in Lebanon by pushing Hariri out, creating chaos, pressuring Hezbollah, and trying to reduce Iran's links to Hezbollah in Lebanon. But most of these attempts have failed. This is one of the great tragedies of the Saudis today, as they become much more dynamic around the region, militarily and in other ways. In almost every initiative they've taken, they've failed, and they don't quite know what to do about it, but they keep lashing out, and we're seeing that happening now again.
Okay, so then this is interesting context for the third major event that happened, again, in just 24 hours in Saudi Arabia, and that's the arrest of 17 princes and top officials on graft charges. I mean, some of the wealthiest figures in the Arab world here, Prince Alawid bin Talal, Saudi media mogul Walid Al Ibrahim. I mean, like, these are enormous figures in Saudi Arabia. All of a sudden, they're arrested for graft charges. What's the significance of that?
Well, this is the most dramatic political internal development in Saudi Arabia, really, in the last century almost, since the Saudi state came into its current shape. And this is a wholesale clean out of the top tiers of the three critical branches of governance, which is the military, the business community, and the media that holds it all together in terms of public discourse. And they've hit all three of them, and they've brought all kinds of powerful, very powerful people who were core to the regime, brought them now into house arrest, and bringing total control of the levers of power under the thumbs of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, and a few of his colleagues, and centralizing power within the royal family in his branch.
So let me ask you about that, because he was Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, as you just pointed out, he was 32 years old when he rose to power just a couple of years ago. So is this Prince Salman cleaning house in a way that's good for Saudi Arabia, or is it perhaps a dangerous consolidation of his power?
Well, we don't really know, yeah. Actually. You know, Saudi Arabia today is like the Kremlin in the 1960s, but you don't really know who's making decisions, who's collaborating with who. You have to try to guess. But he's clearly concentrating power in his hands. He's getting rid of any potential competitors. So other princes who could have been contenders for the throne, he's gotten them out of their positions, and some of them under house arrest, charged with graft now. And he's consolidating power, military power, political power and economic power, and he's leading a massive reform program for every aspect of life, economic, political, social, etc., in the country. So he's hugely ambitious, but he's also massively inexperienced, and he doesn't really have any experience in any of these things. And his problem is that the initiatives he's taken, the boycott of Qatar, the siege of Qatar, the war in Yemen, the internal reforms, and now the Lebanon process, all of these have failed so far. Right. So he doesn't have any victories, but he is very dynamic and impressive in many ways.
And just as all this was going on, we're also seeing a report that yesterday Saudi state media reported that another Saudi prince and seven other officials were killed in a helicopter crash near the Yemeni border. They're not saying the reason why, but that's just yet another thing that happened in Saudi Arabia this weekend. Rami, my last question to you is this. I mean, how should the United States view everything that's gone on here? Because I'm seeing that the New York Times reported that Jared Kushner made a secretive trip to Saudi Arabia just last week. President Donald Trump tweeted over the weekend that he wants Saudi Aramco, the state oil company, to hold its IPO at the New York Stock Exchange. That would be the largest IPO in history. I mean, should the United States be viewing this weekend's events as a positive for U.S.-Saudi relations, or should they be cautious because it could be a catastrophic escalation of that proxy war we're talking about between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Well, it's a proxy war is one thing which the Saudis have lost in the last 20 years because Iran keeps getting stronger. The Saudis keep bumbling, but they keep trying. So the proxy war is one thing. The other thing is the new American policy in the region represented by Trump and Jared Kushner, which seems to be focused on commercial deals as well as political ideology. They haven't made any dramatic new political deals or moves in the region, a little bit on Iran, and they seem to be telling the Saudis, we'll support you in anything you do as long as you keep buying stuff from us. So it's ironic, but telling that Trump would, in the middle of this, would talk about the IPO being in the New York Stock Exchange. The reality is that most of what the United States and the Saudi Arabia and others like the United Arab Emirates have tried to do in the last 15 years has not worked. Iran is getting stronger, Hezbollah is getting stronger, and the others are still confused about what to do.
Well, Rami Khoury is a professor at the American University of Beirut and a senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Rami Khoury, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
The shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, that left at least 26 people dead comes just a month after the massacre in Las Vegas, in which the shooter killed 58 people. And it's raised a question, do mass killings beget more mass killings in a copycat effect? Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, has been looking into that and joins us now. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And it does seem like we're seeing more of these mass shootings than ever. Is that true? Can you put this latest tragedy in context?
Sure. 26 people, as you said, shot dead in Sutherland Springs. 58 people, as you said, shot dead in Las Vegas on October 1st of this year. And then 49 people shot dead in Orlando on June 12th of last year. Those are three of the five worst mass shootings in modern U.S. history, and they all happened in the last 2 years. Two of them occurred within the same 2 months. So these statistics should simply make us wonder whether there is some sort of social influence, some sort of contagion effect that is at play here.
And what does the research say about that?
There's a 2015 paper out of Arizona State University. It's called Contagion in Mass Killings and School Shootings. And it says, yes, there is some evidence that mass shootings occur in bunches because they infect one another. They infect potential murderers, not unlike a disease. The direct quote from the abstract of that paper is the following. Quote, we find significant evidence that mass killings involving firearms are incented by similar events in the recent past. This is not a extraordinary finding. Suicide has been tied to this sort of social influence. Terrorism has been tied to this sort of social influence. It is pretty well established that all sorts of events, positive and negative, can spread through contagion through mass media, such that one extremely popular, well-distributed event suggests that other people follow up. So it's a rather bold finding, but it's definitely in keeping with previous research findings.
On the other hand, I can hear people saying, well, the shooting that just happened in Sutherland Springs had nothing to do with the shooting that happened in Las Vegas.
Of course, it is possible that this is coincidence, and that is the reason why I think that the answer is we should study this question more. Tornadoes have been about as deadly as mass shootings in the U.S. in the last half century. We spend millions and millions of dollars studying tornadoes, studying how they happen, where they're about to occur, how we can predict where they're about to move. If mass shootings are another phenomenon that are capable of being studied, we should be spending millions of dollars on these. And instead, we have sort of scattered research. We have one analysis by Mother Jones, one analysis by the Minnesota Department Department of Corrections. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. But we should be spending more, I think, on figuring out exactly how mass shootings happen and why they seem, and I want to emphasize seem, why they seem to cluster. Whether there is some sort of contagion event, whether they are infectious, or whether it is, as you suggested, a mere statistical coincidence.
Well, a lot of people are asking a lot of questions today after what happened in Sutherland Springs, and I want to listen to one of those questions. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, was on CBS this morning, and Gail King, the host there, asked him what could be done to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people like the man who was apparently behind this attack. Let's listen to their exchange.
We all agree praying and hugs are very good, but what can we do to keep these weapons out of people that you were saying yourself are evil? What can we do about that?
Well, and the important thing is if you go back to early times of this world, to the times of yesterday and last week, evil exists in this world, and is what I'm going to use the words of the citizens of Sutherland Springs themselves, and that is they want to work together for love to overcome evil, and you do that by working with God.
So notably, no mention of gun control there. Do you think, Derek, after what we saw in Las Vegas, and we've noted that there hasn't been any action on bump stocks at the federal level since then, that after what we just saw in Sutherland Springs, that there will be any action on gun control?
I'll be very blunt, Jeremy. The answer is no. The U.S. Constitution puts the right to own a gun right next to the freedom of speech and religion, and the Bill of Rights has an unambiguous amplifying effect. The First Amendment has made free speech abundant in the U.S., and the Second Amendment has made guns abundant in the U.S. And here is a simple fact that is true both between states and between countries. Where there are more guns, there are more gun-related deaths. The U.S. rates of firearm homicide, child firearm mortality, and gun-related suicide are several times higher in the U.S. than they are in any other industrialized country. Here is a striking fact. The U.S. is home to 5% of the world's population under 15. And we are home to 90% of the world's unintentional firearm fatalities involving that age group. Hmm. Is that because America's kids are 15 times more likely to misuse a gun? Is it because they are 15 times more likely to have mental health problems? No. They simply have an order of magnitude better access to guns than children of similar ages around the world, and 7-year-olds do not know how to handle a firearm. And that is why we are home to 5% of the world's population under 15 and 90% of the world's unintentional firearm fatalities.
Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, thank you. It's here and now.